reconvene. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome you all. And we want to especially welcome some high school students we have with us today who have come with the program we call Court with Class. This is a national award-winning program sponsored by the Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students from around the state are invited to join with us at an oral argument. If they accept the invitation, they've been given the briefs on the case that we're about to hear and have done work on this case. If there's anyone in the courtroom who would like a summary of the case we're about to hear, the marshal has one, and if you raise your hand, she will give you that summary. Part of the Court with Class program also provides that the students will meet with a justice after this argument. They will discuss the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the case. Everyone is welcome to join with the justice after the case. Yes?
Chief, do the students know that the case was changed? They know that.
Well, we're going to tell them if they don't, but I think they probably were advised. The case that was scheduled for this time was voluntarily dismissed, and the court accepted that dismissal, and so the afternoon case was put on. The students may not have gotten briefs then of this case, but did get summaries. Yeah, okay. I assume they're very prepared because we have a very excellent staff that took care of this during the week. Okay. Let's meet the students. Central Wisconsin Christian High School students, please stand.
Big group.
We're delighted to welcome you with us this morning. You may be seated. Ashton High School students, would they stand, please? And we're delighted to welcome you also. You may be seated. Let me introduce the court to you all. Standing on my far right is Justice Patience Rogensack. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to her left, Justice David Prosser. And on the far left, Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, I'll call our second and last case for today, 04AP1254. And how do you pronounce your client's name?
Masiolek.
Versus City of Milwaukee Employees Retirement System Annuity and Pension Board. Arguing on behalf of the plaintiff here is James J. Winiarski. Mr. Winiarski.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm sure the court always hears that every case that comes before it is important, and I'm sure the court, in deciding what cases to accept, also considers the importance of a case. But I would just like to say that I believe that this case is of the utmost importance in the probate area, to the probate bar, the elder law bar, because the decision of the court in this case is going to have a very large impact on the direction of non-probate transfers in the state of Wisconsin. I'd like to begin in a very simple fashion.
As long as you raise that issue, I've been wondering, because one of the processes of probate here was going into court and getting a, quote, certificate of authentication. Is that a time-consuming process, sir?
It is, and each jurisdiction seems to have different angles on it. I can relate to Milwaukee best, where I practice. There is a petition that needs to be filed. There's a form fee that needs to be filed. Different commissioners have different rules as to who receives notice of that petition. The particular statute in question here, 867.46, prim 1M, doesn't give a lot of information as to what the hearing is supposed to be and who's supposed to get notice. The client, many times an elderly client, is expected to go downtown, attend the hearing. And so, yes, there is an involvement in this, especially as compared to a non-probate transfer.
Thank you.
I think much of this case is actually very, very simple. 766.58.3F expressly provides that property subject to a Washington will provision passes without probate and in a non-testamentary manner. Likewise, 705.20 is entitled non-probate transfers on death. It then proceeds, after using that word non-probate, to list the property that is subject to that particular section of the statute. Now, in my brief, I cited the definition of probate. In preparing for today, I did some further searching, and I see that in Black's 8th edition, there is now a definition for non-probate assets. And I'd like to just take a moment and read that to the court.
Counselor, before you do, I have a rather basic factual question I need the answer to. Is the global settlement that is at issue here a payout that Mr. Masiolik had a right to under his retirement system with the city?
I'm not sure I'm going to be able to give you a definitive answer. During the course of a deposition in the case of Ann Barr, there was a reference to multiple, I believe it was 20 or 30 factors that went into how this amount each person would receive was computed.
I don't care about the amount. It can be $1. It can be $100,000. I want to know what his right to this money arose from. Did it arise from his pension with the city?
I really can't answer that question because I was not involved in the global pension settlement case. I know it involved years of litigation in Milwaukee. I know it took into account many different aspects of the pension system.
Isn't it the city's retirement system that you're up against here in this
That's correct.
Okay, well, why are you up against them if this global settlement does not arise out of his retirement benefits?
Well, I think it's a combination of his employment and retirement. I think that's the way I would answer it.
Did he designate a beneficiary here of these?
I don't believe he could.
Okay.
So there was an initial form that's in the record where he was asked to consent. Everybody is my understanding that every employee had to consent to participate in this program. There was, I believe, an opt-out. You could have continued to pursue whatever was being pursued in that litigation. Again, I was not a party to that litigation.
But
I'm sorry.
The nature of the asset is really not of great significance here, is it? I mean,
I don't believe so.
MARS owed him money.
And I believe under the agreement, the marital property agreement, the Washington will provision, it clearly provides for any assets that would otherwise require probate.
Had he designated a beneficiary under the rules, it would have been paid out immediately to the beneficiary on a death certificate, like insurance is.
I don't know if they had within that program the ability to name a beneficiary. I think that's a question MERS would have to answer.
No such beneficiary is claimed here.
No.
Okay. All right. So we've got an asset that he owned at death.
That's correct.
And the question is, how is the trustee and or the wife, the surviving spouse, going to get it?
That's correct.
All right. So... How is she going to get it?
That's correct. And in my particular part of the practice of law, I'm interested in getting those assets to individuals as quickly, as easily, and as cheaply as possible, as I'm sure most elder lawyers and probate lawyers are. Now, the definition of non-probate assets found in 8th edition of Black's is as follows. I think it's very important. property that passes to a named beneficiary upon the owner's death according to the terms of some contract or arrangement other than a will. Such an asset is not a part of the probate estate and is not ordinarily subject to the probate court's jurisdiction. And I think that last phrase, and is ordinarily not subject to the probate court's jurisdiction, is extremely important in this case. Because, again, both the statutes that I've just cited clearly make use of the phrase non-probate. So if we are going to take this statute, both of these statutes, 70520, 766.58 3F, on their face, they provide for non-probate transfer. If we take that definition, we clearly have a situation where they are not part of the probate estate. They are to pass ordinarily outside the probate court's jurisdiction. That definition is confirmed in Moto's legal glossary. They have a definition.
And, Steve, let me interrupt you at this point. My understanding was that the Court of Appeals thought it was significant that the Milwaukee City Retirement System was not in any way a participant in the marital settlement agreement that was involved here, the marital property agreement. And the definition that you read earlier seemed to very much depend on an agreement. If the retirement system is not a party to that agreement, why should they be bound by it without some further action such as they demanded?
That is the very reason why the legislature passed 70520, and the provision is found in 766.58 3F, so that is no longer an issue. Non-probate.
Well, the Court of Appeals felt it was indeed an issue and seemed to find that very significant. So what you're saying is they misinterpreted the statutes?
Yes. I think the statute, I just read the definition to the court, two definitions. I didn't finish the second. And if you look at the statute, why do we need to look beyond that is my point. It is very clear from the statute what the mechanism is. It is a non-probate transfer. If I can just answer your question with an analogous situation.
Sure.
Powers of attorney have become part of almost every estate plan that any lawyer does. A health care power of attorney under Chapter 155 and a financial power of attorney under 24307. Mom and dad give power to each other in typical powers of attorney, and they normally name a child as the backup in those powers of attorney. In my example, dad has passed, mom is suffering infirmities of aging. Son, the child name, needs to take care of mom's assets. Guess what? The banks where he goes with that power of attorney have never seen it. They're not a party to that agreement. And that document does not need to be confirmed by any court before that son can use that document. So all of the arguments that MERS make are dealt with every day. Imagine what it would be like if every power of attorney needed to be, quote-unquote, confirmed by a court or an agent before they could take care of mom's affairs and needed to run around and take care of
things. Here's my problem with your argument. In 70520, there's a reference to Chapter 854.
Correct.
In 766.58 3M, this is just right below the Washington will provision that you rely heavily on, it says, Chapter 854 applies to transfers of debt under a marital property agreement. Chapter 854.23 provides that a payor, which is the retirement system, right?
Correct.
Is not liable for having transferred property to a beneficiary designated in a governing instrument. So this is a protection of the payor section, which these other sections say apply. And governing instrument means a verified statement under 865.201.
No, it says includes.
Includes. I accept that. A certificate under 867.046.1M and a recorded application, which is your HG 110, under that. So it includes. which means that you've got to get something else that sort of fits that. Something that is similar to one of these. So what is it that you would suggest that falls under 854.23 that would cover it? Because it doesn't come under 865.201. It doesn't cover under 1M. And I think it's arguable that it doesn't come under 867.046.5 because it's not surviving joint, surviving marital property.
Chief Justice, the word include, as I argue in my brief, to me is a word of addition, not a word of limitation. So thus you will look back at 854.01, where the term governing instrument is defined to include all of those things found in 705.20, and it is also defined to include a marital property agreement. If you look at the scope of that section, that chapter, as expressed, I believe it's in 854.02, the whole purpose of Chapter 854 was to take all the traditional probate concepts and rules and apply them to non-probate transfers. And thus, it applies by definition. Governing instrument includes all of those things. So I believe in 854.23, when the legislature indicates three more provisions. It includes three more provisions. That is not at the exclusion of everything that is found in the basic definition of 854.01. Also, I would just add as further evidence of that intent, if you look at the provisions in 854.23, there is a provision that is partially cited by MERS in this case, where they indicate that the provision is only applicable to events that take place under the chapter, but then it says, and any other good faith effort taken by a payor, in other words, payors are protected if they do anything in good faith, and that was the whole reason for 854. So I think to answer your question, you must look at 854.01, you must look at 854.02, and you have to look at the in 854.23 in its entirety. I also would add that 854, the references in 705.20 and in 766.58.3F, were specifically added when 854.23 or Chapter 854 was passed. So they wanted those protections to apply. Otherwise, there'd be no reason for the legislature to specifically add that 854 language to both 705.20 and 766.58F.
If you were a careful payor, wouldn't you insist on 854.23? And why would 854.23.1 have a special definition of governing instrument and not rely on 854.01? If it's the same and it includes all of those, why do you have a special definition in 23? Now, I totally agree with you that's an includes, but not otherwise. And it's all part of the same statute. It was all adopted in 97, Act 188.
I am not going to stand before this court and say that the marital property statutes, the non-probate statutes in this state are perfectly drafted. We knew when we passed marital property law, we were talking about trailer bills before the law even was enacted. So we knew there was going to be a lot of fine-tuning, and I agree with you, Chief Justice, that in many parts of the statutes that are in question in this case, that I think we could have drafted them using different language and more clarity to establish what we wanted. But I think it's very clear that 854.23 provides the protection to MERS that they were seeking in this case. I just want to take a brief moment to deal with the historical development. I think it's very important that the court understand. When I started practicing law, there was only formal probate. There's a movement within our country and within our state to make all of this much easier. We had informal probate. We had summary assignment. We had summary settlement. We had HT-110s. We have joint tenancy. We have life estate terminations. We have POD accounts. All of this was designed to make it easier for people to get their hands on probate assets. And it is very, very important. This is a very important thing, particularly to the elderly, who, you know, literally the first words out of their mouth when I meet with them for estate planning is there any way I can avoid the probate court going downtown? So this was the reaction that the legislature had. And again, if you just look at those statutes, they are entirely clear. It's only when you look for reasons to not accept that. Where is there anything in 70520 that says non-probate transfers are to occur? We really didn't mean non-probate. What we meant was you now got to go out and get a confirmation and you got to get a court order to do it. If the legislature had intended that, they would have so stated, and they didn't. So if you take them right on their face, if you look at those statutes, you look at those definitions, on their face, there's nothing more that needs to be done. And that's the whole purpose of non-probate, to make it easy. All these fears that the Chief Justice made reference to in a sense that the Court of Appeals talked about, you know, possible fraud. Well, the drafters of the Uniform Non-Probate Transfers on Death Act made reference to them. They really don't exist in great number. I made reference to powers of attorney a few moments ago, and I know this Court has dealt with cases where powers of attorney have been abused. But the reality is the good far outweighs the bad. And these, just like in a lifetime with powers of attorneys, non-probate transfers can occur on death without all of this additional procedures that people don't need to go through. The evils, as the note to the non-probate transfers on Act says, really don't exist. They've never materialized. Now, if I can just go one step further, the interpretation that MERS wants to give to 70520 makes that statute almost meaningless. Here we're dealing with a marital property agreement, and we're dealing with a surviving spouse. I refer to that as a very clean situation. But 705 allows all sorts of non-probate transfers, even between non-spouses. Let me give you an example. Uncle Jack has a note due him for $65,000. He wants to arrange to have that note left to his nephew, Paul. He has a 70520 agreement drafted by an attorney. He signs it. He dies.
What does it say?
It says that note is to pass to his nephew, Paul, without any type of probate, and incorporates the language of 70520 as the marital property agreement does here in this case. And he also adds, and this note must be paid. He uses very strong language, as Agnes did in the marital property agreement here. Well, guess what? There isn't any procedure to get that property to him in a non-probate fashion. So the legislature made a statute for non-probate transfers, and there's absolutely, if you don't accept the fact that it should be paid based upon that non-probate agreement, there's no way to get it there except a formal or informal probate. None of those summary procedures are going to enable Paul to get his hands on that money that Uncle Jack left him in a non-probate fashion. One step further, you can get a personal representative appointed in a formal probate proceeding, but the drafters of the Non-Probate Act, as the young court accepted and noted in the case, the personal representative has no authority over non-probate assets. So getting a personal representative appointed, that person is not going to have any authority. It comes very close to no solution for Paul if you don't accept the expressed, simple language of 70520.
Let me just ask you that, because it does include a marital property agreement. So if I have a marital property agreement and it says all our property is marital, means 50-50 between husband and wife, and on my death, I want all that property to go into a trust that I've already set up, right?
Well, most of the time, Chief Justice, the attorney is going to advise the people to make sure the trust is funded, and that means titled in the name of the trust. The marital property agreement is kind of a safety net. Did you forget something?
And that's why I'm phrasing my question exactly as I am. And there is some funds in the trust agreement. It is funded. Now I'm saying everything else I own at the time of my death, whether I own it now or I don't own it now, everything else should go into that trust. And we have a house. It's in both our names, not joint, but common trust, common tenancy. Can you just file that marital agreement in the Register of Deeds office and expect good title? Can you go to the bank where I have a significant bank account and say to the bank, Abrahamson, Shirley Abrahamson died. We have a marital agreement. It all goes to the revocable, to the now irrevocable trust. Pay over. Is that what you're saying this means?
Well, you use two different assets there. You use real estate and a bank account. Let me address
that purposefully.
All right. Well, the real estate, there are provisions where you could have that transferred in one form or another. But for instance, with an HT 110, it would be most applicable to that. As to the account, though, that is exactly my position, that you supply them with you file that marital property agreement with the Register of Deeds. If there's any question as to its validity, I don't think you need to under the statute, and you can literally give them a copy of that marital property agreement in exactly the same way in my example before, that son could go take care of mom's affairs. He doesn't need to get anything confirmed. He can sell her house. He can do everything with that power of attorney.
So as a result of the marital agreement, if you have one, no probate, whoever is in charge just goes and collects all the assets just by filing a certified copy. That is?
I think I'm going to stand correct. I think you could simply present a copy of the document, and that would be sufficient. That's correct. But it's seldom going to be a situation where all the assets are under that sort of an agreement, although it would be applicable to all.
Well, the marital trust agreement is generally covers everything.
Correct.
Can cover everything. The trust may be a separate little problem in there because you're advised, if there's a trust, to put all your assets in the trust to avoid it. But we're not talking about that. We're just talking about the marital agreement.
Yes. If a husband and wife fail to fund any of their assets into their trust, and they had a marital property agreement of the kind that is in issue here, yes, that is what 705.20 and 766.58.3F were designed to do. It's to be paid into that, given over to that successor trustee, in this case Agnes, and put into that trust.
And the creditors, who can be many, what do they do?
Well, there are provisions whereby that property could probably be followed down. That raises one of the issues that MERS raised in this case, why is 867.046 pren 1 M on the books isn't rendered meaningless if we can do all this? Well, that's part of the answer. Sometimes attorneys, if they see creditors out there, may very well want to open a court proceeding of some sort to formally give notice to creditors. Another reason that we do that I'm dealing with a transfer agent in Boston or New York. Try to explain marital property law, marital property agreements, and Washington will provisions to a non-marital property state transfer agent. You're not going to get anywhere, so you might elect to use it. There might be, in your case, Chief Justice, there might be multiple items of property that you want listed that you need to get at, so you might elect to use it under those circumstances. The problem in this case is it's not mandatory to do that. The statute is clear. You don't need to do that. Again, I'm just going to go back. Some of the questions lead me to want to say it doesn't have to be that hard. We have to let go of this concept that all of us saw during our careers that, you know, you have to get some sort of court order. You have to get some sort of confirmation. Just as I said in the example of the powers of attorney, that doesn't have to be anymore. It works. It really can be quite simple. Thank you.
May I?
Justice Prosser.
Counsel, there is always the possibility that you will not win here. What would you do statutorily to make sure that you would win the exact same case the next time?
How would I change the documents that I drafted in this case?
Statutes.
How would you clean up the statutes?
Mm-hmm. Oh, how would I clean up the statutes? I would probably add to 70520 a language that says that none of the other summary procedures or probate procedures are mandatory to accomplish a non-probate transfer. I think that it would only be necessary there. And again, see, to me, you're making me state the negative when it should be MERS who wants this to be a requirement that isn't there. But that would clean it up. And I don't think you'd have to change 766.58.3F because it's incorporated, by reference, in cross-referenced, I should say, in 70520. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Nuslock, representing MERS.
Yes, Your Honor. Prior to the time that the argument commenced today, I did hand the clerk some exhibits. I've given Mr. Winarski some copies of the exhibits. They are three of the statutes that we have been discussing so far this morning, 70520, 766.58F, and 867046, I've only reproduced those statutes with some highlighting in bigger type for easy reference. And as both counsel have referred to those statutes during the argument, I had just had exhibits made. Your Honor, MERS, as we've referred to the pension board throughout these proceedings, is asking that this court affirm the two core holdings in the Court of Appeals decision. And one is that the holder of funds belonging to a deceased person is entitled to require the claimant to comply with Wisconsin statutes to confirm that he or she is the rightful recipient of those funds. And number two, once Mrs. Masiolik elected to rely upon what is called what we've been calling the Washington will provision in the marital property agreement, the only procedure in Wisconsin statutes that would effectuate the transfer of global pension settlement benefits belonging to Gerald Masiolik solely was under WISSTAT section 867-046-1M.
Counselor, does the retirement system have any contractual right with either Gerald or a successor to his interest to require what you're asking us to do?
No. I mean, there is no contract that says MERS has, as between MERS and Gerald, that Gerald said, subject to this agreement, I will authorize you or I will use 867-046-1M. What Gerald Masiolik did do when he consented to the settlement, and it is in part of the appendix, his consent form said that he would consent to the procedures to effectuate that transfer. And I know I'm not quoting it verbatim. I don't have it in front of me. The other point is that there is no other way to recognize that Mr. Masiolik's interest in these benefits has been terminated.
Well, why can't you accept 70520-1A, which you've got highlighted? Now, this is a money or benefit due, right?
70520 is a statute which itemizes the types of transfers which can be categorized as non-testamentary. 70520 does not mandate does any transfer. It does not mandate the particular procedure. It itemizes instances in which the transfer can be done without probate administration, meaning that the document doesn't have to be executed with the formalities of the will. A personal representative or a special administrator does not need to be appointed. The testator or the testator's representative does not need to file an inventory, does not need to seek court approval of the distribution of the assets. The representative does not have to file an estate tax form. There are all kinds of things that under 70520, a non-testamentary disposition alleviates the recipient of the funds or the holder of the funds from doing. But 70520 does not provide one mechanism by which the deceased's interest in the property is terminated or the claimant's interest in the property is affirmed.
Counselor, there's a document that's in supplemental appendix at page 176. It's entitled Employees Retirement System of the City of Milwaukee Claim and Proof of Death. Why isn't that document sufficient to establish her interest and terminate his interest?
This claim form claims that Agnes Masiolik individually, at least the way it says name of claimant, it says Agnes Masiolik individually, and yet all of these proceedings, in fact, Mr. Winarski's argument has demonstrated that it is the trust account that is claiming and stating to be the rightful claimant. This document was one of the forms and part of the process that MERS put in place to effectuate that transfer. When you think of the thousands of employees that are in the City of Milwaukee retirement system, and the thousands of not only current employees but former employees like Mr. Masiolik who were affected by the global pension settlement, there had to be systems put into place. There had to be measures that would attempt to account for the different circumstances. Is this a first marriage? Is this a second marriage, but there's children from a first marriage? Is there a divorce situation? Is this a situation where the claimant may not be entitled to the funds? So in order to effectuate that, MERS would send out a series of inquiries saying, where do you fall? This is one of the first inquiries.
Did he have a right to have a beneficiary for these settlement proceeds?
At the time that the consent to the settlement was signed, there was not a provision for a beneficiary. Subsequent to Mr. Masiolik's entering into this consent, the process was changed, and then there was provision for a beneficiary designation could be permitted.
Did he name anybody?
At the time that he signed it, there was not.
So he didn't get to amend it?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Counsel, I'm looking at Howard Erlinger's book, and I assume you looked at it. And this seems, and I'm reading from page 128, that deals with a discussion of 854-23, which we're dealing with here, of course, the protection of payers and other third parties. And he gives something like the example that you're just giving. He gives the example in the context of an insurance company. The insurance policy has a named beneficiary, but then there's a divorce. And the question is, what is the insurance company's liability if it pays the proceeds to the, now divorced wife without inquiring about the divorce, or pays in spite of the fact that an agent of the company knew of the divorce? He goes on to state, these are the types of problems addressed in 854-23. 854-23, if a payer, a person or institution holding property that is subject to transfer at death, does not have written notice of a claimed lack of entitlement because of a provision in Chapter 854, it can rely on the governing instrument transferring property to a named beneficiary and take other actions in good faith without incurring any liability. I mean, isn't that what 854-23 is all about?
That is what 854.23 is all about. However, 854.23 has no application whatsoever to this situation. First of all, the another distinction, the example that you gave is and read from the book, deals with an insurance agreement, an insurance contract, where the beneficiary or the owner contracted with the insurance company to pay funds to a particular person. We don't have that situation here, and I'll go back to that.
Well, what about
More importantly, what you read confirms that the protection provided by 854.23 is provided only if the transfer is made in contravention to one of the situations in Chapter 854. Has to do with if the recipient of the fund is the slayer of the owner of the funds, if there is a divorce, if the recipient of the fund does not survive by the requisite amount of time. 854.23, by its terms, is limited. The protections that are provided by that section are limited to transfers that are made in contravention of other provisions of 854. We are not talking about that situation here. And simply because, even if we were to assume that 854.23 would protect an erroneous transfer that was made because someone showed up with a document that was entitled Marital Property Agreement and money was transferred, that doesn't justify saying that you ought to conduct yourself in that way. I mean, we have statutes that provide governmental immunity. We have statutes that say, for public policy reasons, that this person cannot be held liable, won't have to pay money out. It doesn't mean that the conduct is right in the first place.
Well, no, but that makes me think of the whole bank situation. I was looking at the legislative history of this particular section yesterday, and the bankers got a little nervous on the proposal, as you well know. And they said, well, you know, we need a little protection when we're paying out $100,000 or $200,000 or lots of money. And so then sub 5 was added to 854.23 to kind of deal with the bankers' concerns. And sub C of 5, that is 5C, I think it is, gives the financial institution a little wiggle room, and that is if they have some concerns about what's going on and who the successor to the account is, that they may, but are not required to, because they've got the protection of 854.23, but the special provision for the bankers, they may, if but not required to, deposit the money in an account with the court as provided under the law, or refuse to transfer the money, or the protection afforded a finance institution gives a couple of alternatives there. So, I mean, they don't even have to do that, but they can. It seems to me the overriding policy of all of this non-probate transfer is just that. So why should you be carved out?
Again, with all due respect, sub 5B refers to transfers that were made in contravention of some provision of Chapter 854. Because it says specifically as transfer is made to a beneficiary designated in a governing instrument who, under this chapter, under Chapter 854, is not entitled to the account.
I was reading from sub C, which says, if a financial institution has reason to believe that a dispute exists as to the right of the parties or their successors to an account subject to the governing instrument, the financial institution may, but is not required to do, any of the following. 1, deposit the account that the court has provided in sub 4. 2, refuse to transfer the account to any person. And then it goes on. But that's what I read.
Yeah. Yes, but again, that provision is specific to transfers made under 854. It is specific to financial institutions. If there were a provision that said any third party that holds funds that belongs to a beneficiary, if there is any concern that that third-party payer, if there's any concern in that third-party payer's mind as to the rightful beneficiary, that they can put the money into an account and the court deals, sorts out who gets that, who gets those funds, then perhaps that's what MERS could have done. But in this situation, there is not such a provision that allows MERS to just deposit money into the court and let the court figure out who
should. No, but then why aren't you under the general provisions of 854.23 since the retirement, entity in Milwaukee or the Wisconsin Retirement Fund or whatever else, they didn't have their lobbyists come in and get a special provision for them. So why aren't they under 854.23, which is entitled Protection of Payers and Other Third Parties?
They are under 854.23 if the transfer was made in contravention of a situation that arose under the statute, but not if it was made.
It's an example of what's in contravention under the statute.
If Gerald and Agnes Masiolek had divorced prior to the date that Mr. Masiolek died, and yet Mrs. Masiolek came and presented the governing instrument, in this case the marital property agreement, and she had obtained the certificate under 867-046-1M. If MERS had, in reliance upon the court certificate affirming that Mr. Masiolek's interest was terminated and Mrs. Masiolek was the rightful beneficiary, had paid the funds out to Mrs. Masiolek, then MERS would not be liable. That's one example.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. You were not finished.
If Mrs. Masiolek, and again, it's not Mrs. Masiolek who's the beneficiary of this fund, of these monies, but if the trustee had come and this example won't work, because I said if the trust had been the slayer, but that's not going to work, but if Mrs. Masiolek was the beneficiary of the funds, if she had slayed her husband, she would not be entitled to.
Counselor, if the form I read from you earlier, which is the claim and proof of death form, if no one had told you there was a marital property agreement here and a trust that they wanted the money poured into, would you have paid her?
Yes, it is.
Simply upon receipt of this claim form?
Yes.
No.
What would you required from her individually in addition to that?
We would have to have looked at the other statutory procedures that would be available, but without a marital property agreement that includes the provision that says that it should not pass by non-testamentary proceedings, she'd probably need to either open an estate, informal or formal, get a summary certificate under, I think it's 865.201. There are some procedures if the amount of the...
So you wouldn't have paid her any money and let her figure out whether she was going to open a state, do a summary procedure, do whatever she could do given the dollar amount of the payout?
If the holder of the funds holds money belonging to a particular person, in this case Gerald Masiolek, simply upon presentation of a document that says, I am Mrs. Masiolek, there is nothing in the statute that, in any statute, that would require MERS to pay that money over to someone claiming to be a spouse.
Okay, so what if you had the same marital property agreement that you had before, but you don't have a trust? It's just to pay to her individually on his death. Would you have paid it with the presentation of that document along with your proof of claim form that I read from before?
No, we would have required the certificate under 867-046-1M, which states that the court will confirm that Gerald Masiolek's interest in the property is terminated and that Mrs. Masiolek, as opposed to the trust, is the rightful recipient.
Have you never paid any monies out of this plan to the beneficiaries of the folks who held it initially because they were employees?
I can't answer that question. I don't have that information. There isn't anything either in what we're asking the court or in what the Court of Appeals decided that says that mandates that institutions such as MERS or banks or anybody else that, that holds funds go through these procedures.
Well, the problem that I'm having with all of this, which is probably clear from my questions, is that it isn't your money. It's her money either beneficially owned by the trust, right? It's either her money beneficially owned by the trust, but it certainly isn't your money, and it seems like the rules that are being set up are really standing in the way of getting the money that her husband intended for her to have, and I guess that's the problem I'm having with this.
I agree with you that it is not MERS money. MERS is a fiduciary holding that money for the rightful recipient. MERS cannot be put in the position of having to determine who is the rightful recipient.
But my understanding is there's no question that she's the rightful recipient here through the documents that you've been provided. And that's not at issue.
We do not have any other claimants. We do not have any reason to suspect in this particular case that that Mrs. Masiolek, that the agreement is not valid, that it has been revoked, or that Mr. Masiolek intended this property to go to someone else. In this case, that's correct. Yes.
Ms. Nessler, if you have argued or suggested that we affirm the core holdings of the Court of Appeals.
Yes.
Now, I've gone back and I've looked at Judge Gooley's decision at the trial court level that specifically relies on Section 70521A. And he quotes the language in the statute saying it must be paid, it must be paid. He quotes it twice and then he refers to it later in his decision. We've heard Mr. Winiarski argue here for 25 minutes, and I'm sure we're going to hear him for another five, argue that 70520 controls this and that this must be paid. I read the Court of Appeals decision, and it doesn't even mention 70520. Now, if we were to affirm the Court of Appeals, what would we have to address in order to deal with Judge Gooley's decision and the argument here? How would you argue we should frame the opinion to deal with what's missing from the Court of Appeals?
Judge Gooley, at the trial court level, and Mr. Winiarski, in his argument today, I believe, takes the clause 70521A out of context, so that if you read the highlighted portion of the Exhibit 1 that I asked the clerk to hand out, sub A does say money or other benefits due must be paid. But you have to read that subsection in context. It sub 1 says, talks about a provision for non-probate transfer. It says, this subsection governs a written provision that A, B, C, D. So it lists the variety of different provisions. It does not say, 70520 does not say that money must be paid. 70520 says, this provision governs an instrument that provides for money to be paid.
And it also, as I read the section, says marital property agreement, and it says it's non-testamentary.
Yes. And again, non-testamentary means, and this was, I think, set forth quite clearly in the Young case that both parties have relied upon, non-testamentary means that the document need not be executed with the formalities of a will, that there need not be a personal representative or a special administrator appointed to take charge of the assets and liabilities, that that person need not account to the court by filing an inventory seeking court approval. That's what a non-testamentary document does. It can avoid those procedures.
So if I understand what you're saying correctly, what you want in this case is for a court, in the absence of all those documents that would protect the fiduciary here, you want the court to sign off on it without getting that information so that you don't have to worry about it.
I think if the court, yes. I think if this proceeding is filed, if notice is given to potentially interested parties, if no one objects, the court issues the certificate, then MERS is not put in the position of having to determine itself if the agreement is valid and if the named beneficiary in the marital property agreement is the appropriate beneficiary.
One last question. If the court were to rule in Mr. Winiarski's favor and rule the other way, does that not give the city the same protection so you still don't have to worry?
If this court were to rule in a published decision that this was the appropriate method of effectuating that transfer and that if a transfer is made in that fashion, the answer is yes.
Thank you.
That's why you're here, isn't it?
Yes.
You want security, I don't say security, but you, understandably so, you want to be protected. That's why you're here.
Counsel, I know this is a Milwaukee situation, but having served as circuit judge in the central part of the state, under the statute, which is 867-046, opposing counsel made it sound like it was a lengthy proceeding, as I recall. And this goes, this statute was passed in 83, so I was on the bench then. A person in an informal capacity could come into the court, meet with the register of probate, may or may not appear before the judge, but do these things informally, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. We do not have in the record any affidavits one way or the other, but certainly my understanding that in this situation and in others that were confronted by MERS and paying things out, that in fact the deputy register in probate was waiving any court appearances whatsoever.
Yes. And that was my, I just wanted to confirm that because I haven't been on the bench for a while, but I do recall back in the mid-80s that that was a very cursory proceeding. Now, I can't speak for Milwaukee. I don't know their proceeding, but in Milwaukee they could do the same thing.
Yes.
Okay. So you're speaking from, that's your understanding.
Opposing counsel says it really varies in Milwaukee from commissioner to commissioner. Maybe I heard incorrectly. Do you have any response?
That's why I'm asking the question.
He said that who has to be notified and how they handle it varies from commissioner to commissioner.
I don't have any information, Your Honor, as to whether it varies from commissioner to commissioner. I know that in the experience that was related to me by MERS, and this is not my firsthand experience, but the experience that was related to me by MERS, deputy register and probate, was waiving any court appearances for situations such as this. One marriage, current marriage, no other claimants.
All you really want is protection. I mean, from your point of view, the deputy registrar in probate can waive everything, and as long as you get some kind of document, that's it. That's the way they handle it in Milwaukee. I don't know how they handle it in Wautoma. Maybe very different. Marathon County, too. You know, sometimes these registrars, the reality of the world is registrars in probate reign.
I know that we laughed a few minutes ago about you know, if we get the whatever the decision is that MERS may have some protection, and that is why we're here. That under Judge Gooley's ruling, we felt that we had probably the worst possible situation because MERS firmly believed that this was not an appropriate transfer unless statutory provisions were involved. However, it's not a little thing to have that protection. If you look at most of the reasons that we have statutes that provide for the termination of one person's interest and the certification that another person is entitled to those funds is to protect somebody. Maybe it's to protect the recipient so that there aren't claimants that come after the recipient for years and years. Maybe it's to protect the payer. Maybe it's to protect a bona fide purchaser who has no information but purchases the property and without any knowledge of this dispute. The reason for these statutes, the reasons that we have not only these statutes, but statutes relating to the transfer of real estate, the statutes that relate to the transfer of insurance benefits to a beneficiary, is for the protection of somebody. So it is not a little thing that MERS, who is a fiduciary, who has a fiduciary obligation to each and every one of the people for whom it holds funds, it is not a little thing to say that they are seeking protection.
How do you respond to the power of attorney analogy? If I have a power of attorney for finances for a relative, I can go to a bank and take out $50,000, take out $30,000. No one knows. I mean, you know,
if you
as
have
long
a,
as I present it, that's it.
If you have a power of attorney, you are acting in your principal's interests. First of all, you have a fiduciary obligation yourself, but you are not going to the financial institution or whoever it might be and saying, I want you to pay those funds to Kathy Nuslack. You aren't changing the ownership. You're saying, I'm acting in the place of the owner of these funds. The owner, by this power of attorney, has given me authority to act, and you are not terminating that person's interests.
Doesn't the trustee then have that same kind of status?
No, I don't agree with that. Because we haven't established that the trust was the rightful recipient. So here we have property that's titled in Mr. Masiolik's individual name. It's his individual property. By the marital property agreement, it's his individual property. They didn't classify this as marital property. And you have a third party who says, pay me the money. But there isn't, we don't have an instrument, we don't have something that says, terminate Gerald's interest and the trust is the rightful recipient, simply by presentation of the marital property agreement.
So what's the point of 70520? Other than that I don't need two witnesses?
The point of 70520, and I think it's discussed in the Young case, the point of 70520 was really to take transfers that would otherwise have failed upon the death. For example, there is a note that money due or to be payable ceases upon the death of the testator. Because that was prior to the enactment of these statutes, because that would have been considered a testamentary type of transfer, then it would fail because that agreement between the testator and the other person was not executed with the formalities of will, et cetera, et cetera.
So it's just got his signature, no witnesses, right?
Correct.
How does the person whom is designated as the beneficiary of that get the money?
He goes to the special administrator or the personal representative.
You're just saying it doesn't come under 70520. What all this does is say the form of the document is okay.
Correct. That transfer would not, under the old rules before the enactment of this statute, no matter what that piece of paper, regardless of the form of that piece of paper, regardless of the testator's intent, that transfer would have failed.
Chief, if I may, do you know whether or not the Wisconsin retirement system requires when there is a marital property agreement, a Washington will with the trust, whether they require court action like you're seeking?
Yes. They require the summary, the certificate under 867-046-1M.
But if there's a named beneficiary, that's it.
Oh, if there's a named beneficiary, yeah, I'm sorry, if I misunderstood the question.
No, that question was, you've got a marital trust agreement, that's it. No named beneficiary, just like these circumstances in this case.
If there is a named beneficiary, then there is a contract with MERS to pay that money out to the named beneficiary.
So if the marital trust was the named beneficiary, they would pay it out?
Yes.
Yes.
If it's not the named beneficiary, you're saying they would demand a certificate?
Yes.
Doesn't mean they're right, though.
No.
That's for this court to decide.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Nuslack. Let's do it, Ms. Winiarski.
754.23.2A provides not only that a payer or third party is not liable for having transferred property to a beneficiary designated in a governing instrument who, under this chapter, is not entitled to the property, but it then proceeds to say, or for having taken any other action in good faith reliance on the beneficiary's apparent entitlement under the terms of the governing instrument. MERS seeks to avoid and not acknowledge the use of the word or. To have passed 854.23 and to limit it to the three instances the Court of Appeals noted, or to limit it to only 854-type procedures would almost be a farce, if I can use that word. Let me use another example. You're the payor, and you're holding some money that somebody seeks to have paid to them pursuant to 705.20. How are you going to know at the time of payment what a later contestant or other claimant might claim was the reason they were entitled to it? So you're not going to pay it because you don't know the nature of later claims to that money. So if it turns out, according to MERS, that the claim has something to do with a 120-day provision found in 854, then you're off the hook. Or under the Court of Appeals decision, if it's one of those three instances there, then you're off the hook. But if it's something else, you're not. That is not a logical way to look at it. If you're a payor, what the legislature was trying to do here was to protect payers who made good faith payment no matter what the reason. Again, we have this concept here that I heard about this money. I believe Ms. Neslach actually said that MERS told her to open up an estate. I don't think it could be any clearer that the personal representative in the state didn't own this property. The property was owned by Agnes as the trustee. Nothing they can say or do under the law. If you look again at those notes to the Uniform Non-Probate Transfers Act, it clearly states the personal representative has no authority over contractual non-probate property. Agnes was misdirected by MERS into an estate procedure because, again, that's what they wanted. That's what they were used to. They didn't want to recognize new provisions of Wisconsin law. One of the justices asked the question about the form that Agnes filled out. There were many forms that Agnes filled out. One of them was also an indemnity and hold harmless contract that she signed and returned to MERS so that it would make the payment. That's found at record 20, page 50. There were multiple documents. And while I'm on that subject, all of those documents, not in any case, was there any reference to the fact that she might have a marital property interest and that all these surviving spouses had a presumed, under Wisconsin law, one-half interest in all of those benefits. That's never addressed in any of all the procedures that MERS set up in this case. There's a reference in one document to possible, there's no way that people can claim it. They're misled, in my opinion, into going into probate court. Yes.
That was in your complaint.
Yes.
I think it was one of the last paragraphs in the complaint. The trial court didn't have to reach it because you won there.
Correct.
The Court of Appeals said it was not going to reach it because under those conditions she might have gotten half in her own right. And the Court of Appeals said, I'm not going to reach that because it wasn't adequately briefed, I think, or at least fully briefed or fully considered. And you've raised it again here, right?
That's correct.
Do we have enough here on a summary judgment in this record to make that decision, or does that issue, should you not prevail here, does that issue have to be sent back?
That issue was not fully addressed factually or legally in the trial court. It was raised in the complaint. We started to take depositions. A motion for summary judgment was filed. The court granted it to Agnes. and thus that was never addressed in the trial court.
Okay. So should you prevail, it won't make any difference, but should you not prevail on the basic concept that all of this money should be paid into the trust, I assume that part should be remanded.
Yes, it was never addressed.
All right. Counsel, I understand that this is a matter of principle for both, apparently both you and MERS. And it was raised at the Court of Appeals that there's a great expenditure of effort on both sides for this. And apparently, maybe not true, it seems as if it'd be less effort to just get a certificate, you know, pay the $5.
And Justice, I believe, raised that issue. I guess there's background to everything. There's a year of negotiations, a year of trying. I might point out that it isn't part of the record in this case. Immediately upon filing the summons and complaint, a statutory offer of settlement was filed for the exact amount that they always acknowledged was due. Think about that for a moment. At that point, they would have a court-ordered statutory settlement that they so much sought, but they refused to accept that. Pay exactly the penny, no more, just what you know is due. And that was filed shortly after the summons and complaint. There was no desire to stretch this out, and there were multiple occasions, a hold harmless, an indemnity agreement. They wanted a pay pursuant to an order. Well, they got one from Judge Gooley, and instead they appealed. So I could go on that. There were multiple
occasions. I saw that settlement offer in the record. Thank you, counsel. I want to thank both of you for excellent arguments this morning on an issue this Court has not seen before. In fact, we've had very few marital trust agreement cases, considering it's such a complicated statute. So thank you. That ends our hearing on 04-AP-1254, Agnes Masiolik versus the City of Milwaukee Employees Retirement System Annuity and Pension Board. The court is in recess until further oral argument as set forth on our calendar. And other students will be joining those of you who are here. And Justice Bradley will be out shortly.